You know, when I was in school growing up, I used to hate it when teachers would play a movie and then stop it. And I was looking at some of you while we were watching that, and I was like, why can't you look like that when I'm preaching? Even the sleepers were like, oh, video. So try that. Try to keep that face going for a little while. We get to the place now in the sermon where this is what we would call the invitation. If you've listened to any sermon that I've ever preached, or any other Church of Christ preacher, we call it the invitation. It's the end of the sermon. If you've ever been to another denomination, they may call it the altar call. For preachers, you know, we often say to each other, hey, you can circle the airport as long as you want, but eventually you've got to land the plane. The sermon has got to come to an end at some point. And you guys who have come to church for long enough, even if you are one of those sleepers, it's like you wake up because you know, oh, he's winding down. And then you start hearing the noises and people are gathering stuff together and getting ready to stand back up. Some churches even set the mood. And I'm not critiquing them. I'm just telling you, I've seen it happen a lot where the preacher gets ready to wind down and offer that invitation. And then they dim the lights. And then maybe the praise team comes up and starts humming in the background. Or if there's a band, the band starts slowly and softly playing. And it's a way to emotionally engage you. Now, I've never felt like that was necessary because I'm not sure that changing somebody's emotion in the moment leads to lasting change. But again, I'm not criticizing anybody else. Everybody has their invitation, their ending done in a different kind of way. The church that I grew up in, they weren't about the emotions, but we did have one preacher for a few years who, I guess, looking back on it, he probably received a lot of pressure to get people to respond to the invitation. It had to have been. I don't know if the elders were putting that pressure on him or if other members were. And so you could tell he was trying so hard to get you to feel guilty and to come forward. And one Sunday he ended his sermon and then he stood down here, you know, during the invitation song, and he's walking back and forth like a caged lion and he's muttering something. So I'm not even paying attention to the song, I'm just watching the preacher. And then he starts getting louder and louder, and then he interrupted the song leader, and the song leader kind of stops the invitation song, and he just said, I guess everybody's perfect, I guess nobody needs to come forward. And then he just went on this rant, and then the song leader started leading the song again, and nobody came forward. After church was over, a friend's dad came up to me, and he said, I was about to go forward just so he would be quiet and we could finally finish this thing. I don't know. I mean, I guess there's a lot of different views on how the invitation should go and what is the purpose of the invitation. And how do you respond to the invitation? Well, traditionally, I mean, you hear it, you can come up front. You can talk to one of our elders. You can talk to me. We can pray for you if you need to rededicate your life to Christ, if you want to be baptized. Like, you know what we say, and you may know in your heart if there's something going on that you need to come forward. But the invitation, I really believe this, the invitation doesn't end after the 2-minute invitation song is over. Man, maybe you're like me and you just got to process something for just a few minutes. You know, Jesus says in Luke chapter 14, count the cost before following him. So if you need to do that, that's fine. The responding to the invitation could be that you talk to one of our elders and you say, can we talk privately after class? Or maybe that God has stirred something within you and you do find a friend even and you say, let's talk about this. Or you send an email later in the week and you're just like, hey, something that came up in the sermon is something I've been struggling with. Can we talk about that? There's various ways of responding to the invitation. And now in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus offers the invitation. And it's all about making a decision. But it's not what you might think if you read it honestly. We come from an evangelical background, and as a preacher, I'll tell you, the pressure is baptism. Like, you want to get people baptized, and that's always going to be an offer. Colin was baptized on a Monday, so it doesn't have to be Sunday morning necessarily, but Jesus wasn't making a push to get people baptized. He wasn't making a push to get people saved. He was making a push at the end of his sermon to make a decision with the rest of your life. There are two options, and there's no middle ground. There's two paths you can take. It's either going to be the wide way or the narrow way. There's two types of fruit. It's either going to be bad fruit or good fruit, and there's two types of builders. There's either foolish builders or wise builders. That's the invitation right there. Make a decision. Jesus started the Sermon on the Mount with the Beatitudes, the reversal of what the world values, and he offers his blessings. And you could say it this way, now he ends the sermon with some warnings. I would just say, maybe not so much warnings as it is, he's giving you options, but only two options. Let's start in verse 13 and 14, and we'll look at these options that he gives us. He says, enter through the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the road is easy that leads to destruction, and there are many who take it. For the gate is narrow and the road is hard that leads to life, and there are few who find it. Okay, now you have two paths you can take, Jesus says. There's one that's a wide gate and an easy road. In the ancient world, when you would enter into a city, there's probably various ways that you could get in. Maybe the main gate, maybe other side gates that are smaller. The wide gate is the safest way possible. If you take the easy road, the wide road, enter through the main gate in town, it's probably going to take you to the king's palace or help you travel through the city, see all the shops and do all the things that you need to do safely while you're in that city or village or whatever it may be. So Jesus says, yeah, you know about that road. You know about the wide gate, the easy road, but that actually in the kingdom of God leads to destruction. Now, the destruction can be twofold. For one, if you don't follow Jesus' teachings, there's probably a good chance that there's going to be a lot of relationships that are destroyed. If you're not willing to treat others the way that you want to be treated, if you're not willing to seek reconciliation, if you're not willing to forgive, yeah, there's going to be destruction in a lot of your relationships. But Jesus is also talking about destruction as in eternal separation from God. Then he says, follow him, choose the harder road, enter through the narrow gate. In the ancient world, if you found a narrow gate that's not the main road, there's probably a good chance that that road, it's going to be a little crowded and uncomfortable if there's other people on it, and it's not safe. The narrow road is not safe most of the time. You might get robbed, if you got hurt, if anything bad happened to you, you're off the beaten path and people may not even find you. Jesus says, follow me down that narrow gate, the hard road. And he's already said, hey, there's a good chance you're going to be persecuted. People are going to spread rumors about you. Bad things will happen to you if you follow this way. But he says, follow me. There's your invitation, and it leads to life, both life now and life to come. This made me think of a story that John Ortberg, one of my favorite preachers, once told the story about his friend Danny. He said Danny was an adventurous kind of person who was always doing something like cliff diving or skydiving or something like that. And Danny had a friend who wanted to go spelunking. I don't know if I said that right, but what a great word that is. He was going to explore caves. His friend, Danny's friend, said, if you go with me, the path to get where we're going, it's going to be really challenging. But he said, if you can follow me all the way, it's going to lead us into this big opening in the cave with a beautiful pool. So Danny, being kind of a crazy, adventurous person, said, okay, I'll go. And he said that while he was traveling with him through this cave, the ceiling got lower and lower to the point where they were crawling on their hands and knees. And then it got tighter and smaller, and it got to the point where they were laying flat on their bellies and just using their arms to shift through this tunnel. And then he said it got to the point where it was so dark, even this headlamp, you couldn't see anything around you because it was so tight. And he said that to move, you would have to suck in and breathe, scoot forward, and then exhale. And he said at that point, he started to get terrified. Anybody claustrophobic? I mean, I would never be in that situation. But this guy was... And he said the only thing that got him through it was his friend. His friend just said, Danny, follow my voice. I know it's dark. I know it's tight. I know it's scary. Don't think about that. Just listen to my voice, and I will get you there. And I promise it will be worth it. And I thought about Jesus inviting us, hey, follow me. Not the easy road, the hard road, the narrow gate. But Jesus is that voice that guides us along the way. And even though there's going to be some discomfort, if you choose to follow Jesus, if you follow his voice, he's saying, I promise you, the destination is worth it. He continues his invitation in verse 15 through 20. Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. You will know them by their fruits. Are grapes gathered from thorns or figs from thistles? In the same way, every good tree bears good fruit, and the bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a bad tree bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit will be cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus you will know them by their fruits. Now, I just read through verse 20, but here in a second, we'll read through verse 23, and you can summarize it like this. There's the deceivers and the deceived. The deceivers are the false prophets, and we'll talk about the deceived here in just a moment. This leads me to ask the question, who do you let influence you, or what do you let influence you? Jesus is warning them about false prophets. When I was younger, I was really drawn to the Chris McCandless story. He had a book written about him called Into the Wild, and his story is he rejected American materialism, all the money that he had saved up to go get his master's and doctorate degree. He gave it all away to charity. He had nothing left to his name. He hitchhiked his way to Alaska, met a friend, an older man, who let him stay there for a few months. They developed a good bond, but then one day, reluctantly, the old man drove him out into the wilderness in Alaska and dropped him off late winter. And he went to go live off the land. So as a 22-year-old, I thought, I want to do that too. I would have never survived, not even like a day or two. So this is what he did. He crossed a river that was frozen, keep that in mind, and he lives off the land for several months. Now it's springtime. Later they found his journal, and in his journal he wrote, happiness is only real when shared. And so he realized that being alone has been nice, but he needs to go back and be around people. So he packed up and he got ready to go back to civilization, but that frozen river that he had once crossed was no longer frozen. And it was such a raging river that he couldn't cross it. So he was stuck out there for a while until somebody found him. He had a book with him. The book told him which types of berries, which types of fruit he could eat, and which types to avoid. And either he was misled, or he misread it, or didn't see the picture right. But he picked a berry that was poisonous, and he died out there alone. And I thought about his story when Jesus is talking about the good fruit and bad fruit, and I realized, because I don't go around picking fruit. I'll buy it at the store, but I'm not going to pick fruit at your house and eat it. There's just something about that that concerns me. But there's types of fruit that are nutritious and life-giving, and there's types of fruit that are poisonous. Chris McCandless found that out. Jesus is warning about this. He says, watch out, beware. Last week we talked about how Jesus says, if you have a log in your own eye that's just sticking out and glaring, quit trying to get the speck out of somebody else's eye. Don't judge or you will be judged. The measure you use will be the measure that you get. But at the same time, we have to be discerning. So this will require a judgment call. Watch out. Discern who you're letting influence you in your life. There's false prophets. That sounds like a biblical word, doesn't it? In the ancient Israel context, a prophet was somebody whom represented God to the people. God spoke to the prophet spoke to God's people. A false prophet is somebody who claimed to have a message from Yahweh, but actually didn't and still tried to speak to the people. False prophets, or if you want to call them false teachers in the early church, does become a problem. You read through 1 John and many other letters, even Revelation, the letters that Jesus wrote to the seven churches, you see there have been many false teachers who are penetrating the churches and influencing the way people think. So Jesus says, watch out for them. But remember, they're not going to be so obvious. They come to you looking like sheep, but inwardly, they're actually wolves that want to devour. But they look like sheep. They could look like Christians. They might pray. They might read their Bible. They might go to church. They might do some of the things that we do. But they may be false prophets. Well, how would you know? How would you distinguish the true between the false? Well, he says, check the fruit. What does the fruit reveal? Is it good fruit or bad fruit? And I'm assuming, just to answer your question about what producing good fruit is it in the context of the Sermon on the Mount, good fruit would be being faithful to what Jesus taught, and then you trust God with the fruit that's produced from that. Bad fruit are those who don't trust Jesus with what he taught, and instead of loving their enemies, they retaliate and so on and so forth. That's the bad fruit right there. Do you live out Jesus' teachings or not? And then trust God with the type of fruit that will be produced from that. Now, it'd be one thing to look around the room and say, okay, who's the false teacher in here? Who's a false prophet? Go to other churches. Who's a false teacher? Who's a false prophet? Man, it's so easy to do that. You got a log in your own eye, but you're trying to figure out who all the false prophets are. Be on your guard against who you let influence you, but use this as a mirror. Don't look to everybody else out there first. Look within yourself. What kind of fruit is your own life producing? Verse 21 and 23, you have the deceivers, the false prophets. Now we have the deceived. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father in heaven. On that day, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do many mighty works in your name? Then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Go away from me, you who behave lawlessly. That to me is one of the scariest sounding passages. They come to Jesus, Lord, Lord, and on that day, obviously, Jesus is setting up a final judgment day type of scene. On that day, people are going to call me Lord, Lord, Lord. And he's going to say, I never knew you. That seems terrifying. We know that there's people who claim to represent Christ and don't represent Christ very well. There's bad representatives. Now, for these people that Jesus just mentioned, that seems impressive. They're casting out demons in the name of Jesus. They're prophesying and doing mighty works. I would be impressed by that. But Jesus isn't. There's something about their heart, I'm assuming, that Jesus knows what's really going on inside there instead of these outward displays of religiosity or whatever you want to call it. Jesus knows what's going on in their hearts. He's not so impressed by their deeds. We know that there's a difference between orthodoxy and orthopraxy. Orthodoxy is having the right doctrine. Orthopraxy is right living, like actually living it out. They have the right orthodoxy. They're saying, Jesus, you are Lord, Lord. But their lives, the orthopraxy, is not really backing up what they claim they believe. And then the final warning. So he's told us, you choose either the hard road or the easy road. You're going to either produce bad fruit or you're going to produce good fruit. And now he's going to say, you're either going to be a wise builder or a foolish builder. Look at verse 24 through 27. Everyone then who hears these words of mine and acts on them, or some translations say puts them into practice, will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. Stop there for just a second. 4 months ago, 17 weeks ago, I started at the end. I started with this passage. You might remember Josh was leading singing that Sunday. He had the kids come up. We did the wise and foolish man, wise man built his house on the rock, whatever that song is called, the VBS type song. That I started with this. I started with the end because I wanted you to know that as hard as these teachings are, in the end, Jesus does intend for us to act on them. He does intend for us to put them into practice. Throughout church history, there have been a lot of people that have concluded that Jesus sets such a high standard in the Sermon on the Mount, it's impossible. And their conclusion is, you try to live this out, and we fail time and time again, and what it does is Jesus brings us to our knees, and we say, I need the grace of God, I can't do this. Which is true, we need the grace of God. We're not going to move forward at all without the grace of God. But that's not the point of the sermon, is for just to knock you down and make you feel like you're really, really bad. The point of the sermon is Jesus says, I want you to act on it. I want you to put it into practice. In fact, if you do, you're like a wise builder who builds his house on solid foundation on the rock. Verse 25, the rain fell, the floods came, and the winds blew and beat it on that house. But it did not fall because it had been founded on the rock. Storms will come. Build your house, build your life on this foundation, Jesus says, and it'll stand firm. Verse 26, and everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them or does not put them into practice will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rain fell, the floods came, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell, and great was its fall. You know, I put this picture up here that first Sunday. This house was teetering over Lake Michigan. They originally built on solid foundation, but the earth kind of corroded under it, and this house was hanging back and forth over Lake Michigan. So it was a little bit on solid foundation and a little bit just on the sand, on the air. And that's probably a better look of my own life and a lot of our lives. We want to build a little bit on Jesus, but not fully. It's like Jesus is saying, just trust me. Build on this. Live this out. That snapshot of what I showed you earlier. And when the storms come, you'll be all right. But do we fully trust Jesus with this? So I just learned a new word recently. It's called Swifty. Anybody heard of that? Those who are laughing, no. Those who are not laughing, are like, what are you talking about? Is it a, you know, one of those things that you swift and clean your kitchen? No, that's not what it is. So Wednesday, when I was finishing up this sermon, I got an email from a guy who works with ministers. We'll just say that. And he said God placed something on his heart. It was a good email, but he started with talking about Swifties, which are hardcore followers of Taylor Swift. They buy her merchandise, they memorize her songs, pay a lot of money, and they'll pay a lot of money to go see her in concert. They would rather see her in person than die not having seen Taylor Swift. He said in the email that at a concert in Seattle, it was so loud it registered as a 2.3 magnitude earthquake. And he said that collectively, Taylor Swift fans have spent $6 billion to see her in person. So I read that and I thought, hey, that kind of fits with the end of the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus isn't looking for Swifties. Jesus isn't looking for people who are just hardcore admirers, who people who will pay or travel great lengths to hear this great teacher teach. Yeah, he wants to expose you to his teachings, but what he's really looking for are people who are going to dedicate their life to choosing the hard road, producing good fruit, and building their life on this foundation, putting these teachings into practice. The end here, after Jesus offers what would be a strange invitation to us, Matthew gives us two verses. Now, when Jesus had finished saying these words, the crowds were astounded at his teaching. For he taught them as one having authority and not as their scribes. Okay, the authority is mentioned here. They're amazed at Jesus' authority. The scribes, the teachers of the law, their authority is they appealed to the tradition of the elders. Jesus' authority came directly from God and it was noticeable to the crowd. And they're astounded. They're amazed at his authority. Again, Jesus isn't looking for people to just be amazed by him or be admirers of him. He's looking for people who will truly follow him down that narrow road. Now the question becomes, you've read through the sermon, we've preached through it 17 Sundays in a row. How will you respond? That's the invitation. How do you respond to it? The traditional invitation always stands. We always say things like a variation of, you can come up front if you need the prayers of the church. You are always welcome to do that. If you want to be baptized into Christ, and today's the day, you can come up front. If you need to talk to a shepherd, if you want to rededicate your life, you can come up front. That will always be an option every Sunday. Our elders are available to you. I'm available to you. But if you looked at the invitation of what Jesus is offering in this sermon, is he saying, choose the narrow way. All right, I'm looking around the room. A lot of you were baptized a long time ago. And I'm not making fun of your age because I would feel like I was baptized a long time ago too. You chose that narrow road. You're good for life, right? Honestly, some of you, you might have noticed like a river beside the narrow road. And somewhere when you weren't paying attention, you saw a little boat and you drifted off the narrow road and you got in this raft and you just started floating along the river. And you read these teachings and there's a disconnect between your life and what you're seeing and what Jesus is teaching. Maybe Jesus is saying, wake up. Like, wake up, get off the boat, quit floating, get back on the narrow road. Maybe that's the invitation to you. Maybe, watch out for false prophets. Maybe Jesus is warning you. Hey, you live in a world where there's 24/7 news and some of us are obsessed with that. The notifications on our phone, with watching it, with being almost brainwashed by what they're telling you. We scroll through social media and there's a thing called an algorithm that just keeps pumping stuff out at you, and then you see these videos and you're caught up in these conspiracy theories, or you watch YouTube videos and it works the same way, and then before you know it, your life is this unguarded life of a blend of, yeah, you listen to some sermons and read your Bible some, but you got all this other stuff influencing you. Maybe the invitation to you was Jesus is saying, wake up. You pay attention. You guard who and what you let influence you, and put people in your life that will influence you in a way that you will produce good fruit. Or maybe you've sang the songs, and you do that most Sundays, or when you show up, and then you read that passage where he says, there's going to be people on that day that say to me, Lord, Lord. Maybe you realize, I've been offering a lot of lip service. But what's behind that? That's the invitation Jesus is offering. And in the end, he doesn't say, all right, come make a decision, raise your hand, or come up front. He says, go and do it. Put it into practice, or you don't. There's two options. There's no middle ground. So everybody has to respond to the invitation. The invitation Jesus gives isn't just for some people. It's a choice that you have to make. So what choice will you make? I want to invite you to stand and let's keep singing.